This is Anjali Jung with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. You're listening to Storytime. This is 9 O'Clock Horses, Episode 8. I must have stared at my father for a long time with my mouth open, because he studied my face before speaking.
"Pauline had it all wrong about the gun," he said, obviously noticing my confusion. "She didn't really see what happened. She was just coming into the living room from the kitchen. I can only assume she saw me when I grabbed Vicky's wrist, so it wasn't in my face. Of course, the gun went off when I did that. The bullet lodged in the ceiling, as you know. Pauline was terrified and ran upstairs for you. She was the one who decided Vicky was trying to do herself in."
"I don't understand," I said. "Didn't you see Mum get the gun from the bookcase?" I was searching his face for answers.
"Amelia, why would I? We all go to the bookcase now and then. You know how I am when I'm reading. I'm not watching what's going in the living room." "Jesus Christ, it's a good thing Pauline didn't see the whole thing. In her mind, I think she could accept the fact that her mother was having a nervous breakdown or she was drunk or something. But to imagine for one minute her mother was about to, well, you know, commit murder?" His voice trailed off, and he reached for the last drops of the port wine, shining deep red in his glass. Then he straightened his tie and sighed heavily. "She could have gone to prison," I said, still not quite believing what had happened. "No, I would have gone to prison. Guns are not allowed in Britain. I didn't have a permit. Anyway, I buried it."
"You buried the gun?"
"Yes."
"Where?"
"Never you mind. I didn't want it in the house."
I kissed his cheek.
"Well, you're a better man than I said.
He patted my hand.
"For better or for worse."
And there the conversation ended, neither of us wanting to dwell on something that had happened years ago. The view of my parents and their eternal conflict, however, would never be forgotten. At least now I was not living in the same house with the odd atmosphere and the undercurrent that ruffled the water constantly. I was getting settled in Kevin's parents' house. His mother and father seemed old even to me, like some of our neighbours on Over Park Avenue. I already knew from Kevin they were older than my folks. His father, Alastair, had retired from business in banking. His mother, Eva, had never worked a day in her life. They were kind to me, but not overly fussy, which seemed appropriate, because they were upper class. The lovely big house, the furnishings, all that. It reminded me of my grandmother Louise's home, with all the things properly placed. Kevin laughingly said, "Yes, a place for everything, and everything in its place, that's my parents." I had my own room with an electric hot plate and a little electric fire. Surprisingly, Kevin was eager to take me to places like Warwick Castle, Stratford-upon-Avon, and Shakespeare's birthplace, and the Globe Theatre, where we saw Midsummer Night's Dream. Of course, when Colin was in Foxby on the occasional weekend, I was with him. In the meantime, Pauline was getting ready to leave for Africa with her 18-month-old daughter, Louise, named after my grandmother. My father and I went with her to the airport, to BOAC's plush waiting lounge with the dark green carpet and a bathroom full of wonderful cosmetics. Air travel was possible only for the elite at that time. There were no jets then to accommodate the hoi polloi. Turboprops manufactured by Rolls-Royce were used in the 50s for most air travel. Pauline said she would write every week or so and let me know how it was in Ghana. Richard had written and told her it was really hot and humid, but they had a large house provided by Singer Sewing Machine Company. And he said he already had decorated one of the bedrooms for the baby. Pauline was excited, even though she did shed a few tears when her flight was announced over the loudspeakers.
You'll come visit? She asked as she gave me a hug. Yes, I'll save my pennies, I promise, I said.
While we were in London that day, my father and I visited St. Paul's Cathedral, built by Sir Christopher Wren in 1675. The first one was destroyed in the Great Fire of London after the plague. The dome is a whispering gallery. You can stand on one side and whisper into the wall. The other person will hear it plainly from way over the opposite side of the dome. I thought it was magic then, and I still do. When we got home, there was a telegram waiting for him from his sister Olive. My parents still did not have a telephone. Grandma Louise was really ill, and according to the telegram, she was weak from pneumonia. I went with my father to visit her. Olive said in a whisper, "It's almost time." I didn't know my grandmother Louise very well, although I had lived next door to her with my aunt and uncle. She never fussed over me. She was always polite but rather distant. It was only then that I noticed both Aunt Olive and my father seemed to accept the fact that the old lady was near death, and of course it had to be expected at her age of 86. They didn't show much emotion. When I tried to analyze that lack of feeling, I came to the conclusion that it wasn't that they didn't feel deeply about things. It was just the English way of keeping a stiff upper lip. By nature, I think the British are less demonstrative than Americans and tend to keep emotion of any kind under control, except my mother. My father's words, "Oh, stop analyzing everything, just get on with it," still echo in my brain. My mother's family was different. Grandma Bond was a fussy lady and always delighted to see us with a tin of chocolate biscuits at the ready. She was very poor, took in washing for a living, had very little education, but never spoke an unkind word of her husband, who had been killed in World War II. She didn't grumble about anything, according to Pauline, who knew her far better than I did. Her house on Grey Street was in the centre of the city. As my mother had explained, it was one of the oldest parts of Leicester. Narrow cobblestone streets crisscrossed each other in a random fashion. Grey Street was, as its name suggests, drab and colourless, with gas lights still used to light the slim sidewalks. Two-storey brick houses all joined together in blocks of five seemed to lean toward the houses on the opposite side of the road. Inside, everything was miniature, one room with a tiny kitchen attached, and steep, narrow stairs that went into one small bedroom. The toilet was outside, in the postage-sized backyard. An alley ran at the back of all the houses on that street. The back gate led to a garden filled with dark red peonies. I remember the house as well as the street, and her garden smelled of gas. To this day, when I see dark red peonies, I swear I can smell gas. I have realized as I've grown older that there was never an outward show of affection in our family, and despite the attention my father bestowed upon me, he was very critical of my attempts to paint or draw. "Well," he'd say, "it's good, but if it had been me, I'd have done it this way." He was a hard taskmaster. It seemed no one, including me, really came up to his expectations. I did learn from him that books were the solution. If he didn't know an answer to any of my questions, he would go to the bookcase and pick out the appropriate book. "Let's look it up, shall we?" At Kevin's house, they also had a library, which meant a lot to me because they were of similar background to my father, where education was a paramount. And Kevin was always the perfect gentleman. I thought of him as a very good friend, but nothing more. It was a total surprise when he asked me if I would consider marrying him. I was stunned. I suppose because of our age difference. He was 30, I was 18. I just didn't think of a romantic alliance. I never even kissed him. I told him I didn't love him, I loved Colin. For a brief moment, I felt a pang of guilt, and I could see he was upset. But, like the gentleman he was, he just sighed and said he understood. After that, there seemed to be distance between us. His demeanour changed toward me, and he no longer offered to take me to visits out of town, where a car was a necessity. I began to feel uncomfortable, and I realized it was unfair of me to stay there with him under the same roof. But the question was, where could I go? I unrealistically thought that perhaps I could go to Africa to see Pauline for a few weeks. In her last letter, she had sounded happy. She'd enclosed a photograph of an African woman with a singing sewing machine balanced on her head. Apparently, the women carry really heavy things that way, and rich Africans buy sewing machines for their daughters because it adds to their dowry and makes them more valuable, a valuable catch for a husband. So I wrote and asked her if it would be a good time for me to visit, but she wrote back and said it was such a third world country, very primitive, I wouldn't like it. I wondered why that would matter if I was just visiting. But she sounded quite firm in her letter. In the end, my refuge, I decided, would again be my aunt's place at Foxby. Then I learned Aunt Dorothy was ill again. I was upset at the news, because I had shared her life when she was a vibrant young woman and so good to me. Uncle Walter was obviously under a lot of pressure, trying to keep his market garden flourishing and worrying about his wife. He suggested that since Grandma Louise had died, Aunt Olive, who now lived alone, would probably welcome my company, and she did. Within a week, I had packed my suitcase at Kevin's home, said a tearful goodbye to him and his parents, and moved in with Olive. I felt like a nomad, wandering from home to home. Not that Olive didn't make me comfortable. She wanted me to share her meals and made sure I was up early in the mornings to get to the bus to work in Leicester. She kept me amused with stories about her life and her siblings, including my father. Their life seemed to me to have been idyllic in the peaceful country village where everyone knew everyone else in the farming community and in the church. Now, half a century later, I was part of that place, a small, ordinary village that I loved. So in one of those glorious summer days in Foxby, with nary a cloud in sight to filter the sun, I closed the gate behind me with its ubiquitous rubber tire nailed to it and strolled along the well-worn path through the field to the bridge where I had arranged to meet Colin. We had not seen each other for a month or so, since the exams for his degree were taking place in London. I stood on the bridge and looked down at the water to watch the ducks paddling along by the bank. Coal barges were rare now, and if they came chug-chugging along, their engines purring, the wash of water in their wake rustled the rushes that now had been trimmed to allow boats of all shapes and sizes to travel the canals. The waterways of England had been forgotten when steam engines began transporting coal to the factories. The canals had become choked with rushes and weeds, but now things were changing. Leisure vessels were becoming popular in the inland canals and rivers. Narrow boats designed to navigate through the scenic countryside of England advertised relaxing vacations on the water at 4 miles an hour. I saw Colin walking through the fields from the farm. He was wearing his Harris tweed jacket with the leather elbow patches. He waved, and my heart began to beat a little quicker. "Hello, sweetheart," he said, giving me a hug and a kiss. He turned to look down at the water below and a family of coots that suddenly appeared at the water's edge. Then he glanced at the field of cowslips. He smiled and turned to me. "Remember when Ellie was here with us that day and you two went off to pick cowslips? I sat on the bank." "I remember," I said. "That's when I knew you and I would always be together." I didn't tell him that was when I had experienced a pang of jealousy because he hadn't picked the flowers alongside of us. When he turned to me and kissed me, his lips soft and warm against my own, he said, "I do want you. You know that, don't you?"
"You mean that way?"
"Yes, don't you think it's time?"
"Well,
I don't know," I said. "I mean, I just don't know. Shouldn't we wait until we're married? For goodness sake, lass, we're both adults now. Don't you love me?
I do. You know that, Colin, but I want to be a virgin when we're married.
He looked at me and laughed, but there was sadness in his big brown eyes.
It's all right, lass, he said, hugging him again. I know.
At that moment, I began to wonder if he would seek sexual satisfaction with someone else if I didn't acquiesce to his desires. The fields were alive with the hum of bees. The scent of blossoms filled the air. I lay with him among the cowslips in the hollow where they grew in profusion. He twisted my hair in his fingers. I wanted to distract him.
I love these flowers, don't you?
Yes, I do. They will be never gone from this field. You know that. And you must remember that.
As he put his arms around me, I could feel he was aroused, and when he put his hands gently on my breasts, I melted. I knew I suddenly wanted him, all of him. It was easy to be swept up in the moment as soon as we were entwined as one. His energy and his need filled me with such intensity, I cried afterwards. We lay for a long moment, silent, until he finally spoke.
The cowslips tall, her pensioners be. In their gold spots you'll see. Those be rubies, fairy favours. I must go seek some dewdrops here, and hang a pearl in every cowslip's ear. He was leaning on his elbows, looking at me.
A midsummer night's dream, he said. You like Shakespeare, don't you?
Some. I said, some. How about where the bee sucks, there suck I, in a cowslip bell I lie.
The tempest, he exclaimed. I know it.
Then he kissed me again, rose, and pulled me to my feet.
We'll remember these moments, he said, holding me close, when we're old and grey.
That evening we went to have dinner at the village pub. Although the Black Bull Inn, built just before the war, was not known for its old-world charm with low-beamed ceilings and sloping floors, it was comfortable and welcoming, with high stools at the bar and cushioned seats in alcoves around the room. The hardwood floors were highly polished, and the smell of beer mingled with the faint smell of furniture polish. The pub was owned by a brewery, Bass Charrington. It was not a free house where the pub owner could choose which beer he wanted to sell. And to me, beer was beer, but not to a lot of men who would drive miles to find a pub that sold Courage Ales or a brewery of their choice. However, the Black Bull was the only public house in Foxby. Customers flocked there with their friends on Saturday nights for chicken and chips or a meat pie. I was sipping a Pimm's No. 1, a gin-based liqueur with fruit juices. Colin had a pint of bitter ale, popular with most men. Women tend to order what is known as shorts, a shandy which is beer and lemonade, like Sprite in the US. There was also a non-alcoholic bitter lemon drink, or wine. Colin was sipping in silence, and I asked him what he was thinking. He looked at me and smiled before leaning his elbows on the table.
You know, I've been at Atkinson Engineering for 5 months now. It's all right, but I was talking to one of the guys there, and he says he's planning to live in America. He's already got a prospective job there. I think I could be hired by Bill Telephone Company. I did some research. They are hiring Brits who have engineering degrees for their drafting department. Would you consider going to the States?
I must have stared at him for a long moment because he said, well, would you?
Wow, I said. Wow, I don't know. I mean, it's a long way from England.
Well, yes. Think of the opportunity, though. Make a better life for ourselves. My mind was ticking over as to why and how. It could not be that easy.
But Colin, I said, trying not to sound smart, secretaries must be like pennies a pound out there. Why would they hire me?
Ah, that's a point, he sighed. Still, we could try, or I could go first and then sponsor you as my wife.
I looked across the table and studied his face.
Your wife? Are you proposing?
"Yes, I suppose I am," he said, looking away for a moment. "I suppose I am. I want to marry you, you know that."
He took hold of my hands as he rested them on the table. His warmth seemed to permeate through my whole body.
"I love you," he whispered.
"And now, after this afternoon, I know you love me." He gripped my hands tightly and I just looked at him.
Was this the key to showing a man that you loved him?
For me, love was an emotional experience. Sex was a very small part of it. In my mind, even though I knew without a doubt I loved Colin, for some reason it left me feeling vulnerable, disarmed, out of control. He hadn't taken advantage of me. I had been willing. So why the feeling of guilt? I wondered now if my brother's incestuous thoughts and action towards me were still there. And if so, how could I face that fear?
This was the end of episode 8 of 9 O'Clock Horses. Tune in next week to episode 9. And thank you for listening.
Ellis here from the Insider Report on behalf of KCIW Podcasting. I'm sure you all can appreciate Angela Ewing's excellent delivery and her interesting story. She serves KCIW as both director and producer on various projects in addition to her writing. One of her several projects is her novel presented as a serial in the grand tradition of the classic radio shows of the 30s, 40s, and 50s of the last century. KCIW is a nonprofit community radio station, and we need your help. If you have an idea for a show, if you want to be on air, if you have the time and inclination, we need sound editors, producers, and talents of all sorts. If you're not inclined to directly participate, you can always give us money, money, money that would be used to buy the equipment we need. We are a community radio station, your community radio station. We hope you're amble over to kciw.org and check us out. We've more than 50 podcasts with many more on the way. Please help us. Thank you and have a great day.